New Life family. It's Becky Brown with your summertime CNL Collective. I hope that there is a picnic on your calendar somewhere. I've heard it said that life's no picnic. And the way I look at it, life is very similar to a picnic. Picnics can be rained out or attacked by an army of ants. You know, life be lifin'. Our expectations of how life will be are sometimes dashed or extremely bent out of shape and unrecognizable. So, as in life, we put up an umbrella or move to an area that is not abounding in tiny black ants. That is where New Life comes into play. We provide an umbrella of hope in the most challenging situations. And we're here to offer you tools to combat those ants. And by the way, did you know that ANT stands for automatic negative thoughts? You may have heard us say that before. Whatever the struggle is, we're here to help you. Our first call to share today is from Rebecca, a single mom with two young children. Chris Williams and Dr. Jill Hubbard address why she never feels like she does enough in today's world. Following will be two teachings. First, a short teaching by Dr. Jill Hubbard on ADHD, and another is from our presenter at both Everyman's Battle and Intimacy in Marriage, J.J. West. He'll talk on secure attachment, which was shared on the May Club New Life Zoom.
Let's now talk to Rebecca, who is in Bismarck, North Dakota. First-time listener, how can we help you today?
So I am a single mother of two. I think throughout my whole life, I've struggled with, being motivated, doing what I'm supposed to do to get ahead. And then, of course, I have struggled with alcohol addiction throughout my life, and I'm currently going to treatment and counseling and stuff, and feel like I'm, you know, pretty much going through the motions that I'm supposed to and trying not to lose hope. But my biggest concern is, you know, my two children in this go-go world, getting to that point of, you know, not losing hope on getting to, you know, be able in a better spot to provide for my children and not feeling idle. You know, I think we can put too much pressure on ourselves, but at the same time, there's always more to be done. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that interferes with connections with people, too. Like, might have ADHD. I don't know. I know my son was diagnosed with it, my 10-year-old. But just your mind races so much. You know, it's so hard to slow down and actually listen to people. And, you know, I feel like almost selfish sometimes when that happens, you know. So
you feel selfish when
all over the board here,
no, that's but, okay. And yeah, your son has ADHD. It's highly likely you might too, but being a single mom of two, and that has been my life for the last couple decades. There is a lot to do, and you're only one person. And it's really common to feel like you probably don't do anything 100%, because I imagine you have to work some as well to support your children.
Yeah. Right now it's part time while I'm in treatment, because
right.
That's my priority right now.
And
but yeah, I want to be more self-sufficient and like have that better example for them. You know, you work
it's
hard
a good goal.
In that. And it's just it's something I've struggled with my whole life. And then, you know, I just feel like I'm not that go type person. I get tired, you know.
Well, yeah, it is tiring. And we need a balance of pursuing our goals and then resting. And when you're a mom and you're working, there is little time to rest. But it sounds like that gap for you of where you are struggling and feeling like you are constantly falling short, because people with ADHD always feel like they're playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you have used alcohol to fill that gap, to kind of make it go away. Then that just gets you further behind. So, you know, kudos to you, Rebecca, for being in treatment.
Yes.
To try to change the narrative, to do something different. And it's not just about you being more motivated. It is that day at a time. What can I do today to help myself?
Well,
what can I do differently today?
Absolutely. And in addition to that is, Rebecca, I hear the tremendous pressure that you're putting on yourself.
and the tremendous pressure that you put on your life. And I believe that you're suffering from a horrific ailment. It's called never enough-itis. Right. And so you're just kind of feeling like, I'm never going to be enough. It's not mm-hmm. going to be good enough. It's not going to be this. And so it speeds up that anxiety, which anxiety exacerbates the ADHD symptoms. And then it cycles back on itself. And you can hear my rapid speech and it goes, oh, mm-hmm. and then eventually we just get in a state of paralysis mm-hmm. there. And so, okay. So I'm going to challenge something. You said, I'd love to be more self-sufficient. And I'm like, I would rather you be more other supported, that you have other okay. people support you in your life. I'm glad you're in recovery mm-hmm. because the fellowship in recovery, especially the 12-step rooms, can really support you. Getting involved in our life recovery program could really support you and help you here to calm the anxiety and the chaos that's inside of you, to be able to relax. Because what your children will need is not for you to accomplish a bunch of things in life. Mm-hmm. They'll need you to right. just be there for them.
Yeah, your presence.
And that God is going to lead you, guide you, provide for you as he's also equipped you well to do cool things in life. But the anxiety and that never enoughness is working against you, not for you.
Right.
I'm not sure how old you are, but with young children, you can't be terribly advanced in age.
I'm getting close to 40, so.
Okay.
Oh, wow. You're getting up there.
No problem. But there's a new mantra I want to give you. Two, actually. It's two.
Okay.
I'm enough and I'm right on time.
Okay.
You're not behind. You're right on time.
That's really hard to remember, but yeah.
I know.
Especially when I struggle with being on time.
Yeah, okay. You're just solidifying the ADD diagnosis.
Thing. Yes, yes. So hear Jill well on that.
It's a number one symptom that nobody talks about.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to encourage you to seek out women like Jill in your community that can help support you and return you back to those messages that you're enough, God's enough, and you're right on time.
Yes. Say that again, because I think you need to write that down, Rebecca.
Okay.
And that this, remember, ADHD is a brain issue. You would never tell your son he isn't enough. Your brain just works differently.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy to shame oneself because of a different brain.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of wonderful things about ADHD people, right, Chris?
Absolutely.
They're bright and highly creative and really super fun and spontaneous.
Yes. They can think very quickly.
Yes.
And chaotically all the same
time.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. So
you're
not alone. I'm going to talk about living day to day with ADHD.
Okay.
So the ADHD brain, which is also a neurodivergent brain, which is important to know because a lot of times we don't recognize that in a way that is helpful for people. And there's some common comorbidities with ADHD, and that is anxiety, depression, and substance abuse goes along. And it's interesting that there's also a really high percentage, and probably everyone knows this, of people in prison with ADHD and learning disabilities. So there's a lot of feelings that go into having ADHD and how a person feels about themselves and their inability to be, you know, like neurotypical brained people. And so some of us on this team have also, you know, struggled with these issues and have had the fortune of passing it on to our children.
Yeah.
So I had a situation that happened this last week with my adult son. I say adult loosely, but he is an adult. He gives me lots of material. In fact, he called me on the way here and he says, what are you talking about today? I said, you. And he said, oh, okay. Yeah, we'll make this point and this point. I'm like, okay, enough. So over the weekend, we had a family party and it was a lot of work and he came over to help us. And he's kind of a little bit like Pigpen, you know, and he leaves a trail, even though he's really trying to help and he's very dear. And so he gets there and he loses his car. car keys, which is a typical thing of ADHDers. Okay, so then he finds where I've hidden the spare key, and he's got the spare key. And so at the end of the night, I'm really tired, and he's getting ready to leave, and it's taking him like an hour to leave. Well, he's lost the spare key.
Oh, no.
And so he could tell my frustration. Mm-hmm. And he turns to me and he says, "Mom, I want you to think about how you're feeling right now. And remember that people have been frustrated with you as well."
Isn't that stuff you've told him before?
Yeah, but then he adds, but on a milder level, you know, so yeah. The kid has insight, yes. And, you know, and self-awareness.
I love your son.
I know, but you know what? I had to reflect back and later, and I actually apologized to him. I said, "You're right. It was a perfect scenario where I was being like my mother."
Yeah.
And I was being, you know, even my heavy sighs, I'm like, oh, expressing that I was irritated at his lack of finding things. Anyway, I had some examples on how to remedy that. One of the things is we have to really be aware that our hands and our brain work separately. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are our hands doing? It's really important to clue in and do a lot of self-talk and to also slow down and think, to ask ourselves what we're anxious about.
Yeah.
And it's really important not to handle important items when we're preoccupied.
That's good.
There has to be more intentionality to take control of our symptoms.
Tonight, we want to talk about being secure connectors. And that phrase, secure connector, is really coming from the attachment theory language. And if you're unfamiliar with attachment theory, I'm going to try to give us a little brief understanding and a little bit of history on attachment, but really want to talk mainly about what it means to be a secure connector and how Jesus is our model for being a secure connector, because Jesus himself was a secure connector. But let's start with a little bit of definition and a little bit of history. So when we're talking about attachment, we're talking about a deep and enduring emotional bond that connects one person to another across time and space. Now, there are some key components there, right? So there's an emotional bond, and it's deep and enduring. It doesn't go away. It doesn't vanish when the person leaves. It's not temporary. It's not transient. It's a permanent, deep, enduring bond. And it connects the people across time and space, meaning that when we're separated by geography or when we haven't seen each other in a long time, that bond doesn't dissipate, that bond doesn't go away. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about attachment. Many of us experienced attachment when we were growing up in our families that we grew up in. We developed attachment with our primary caregivers. We might have developed attachment with siblings or close cousins. We developed attachments with classmates in school, and we developed attachments with teachers and coaches and scout leaders. And all along the way, we developed all these different kinds of attachments, these emotional bonds that helped us to connect with other people. The whole work on attachment theory really developed in the 60s and beyond by John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. And they were pivotal in helping us understand the importance of that attachment, of that bond, of that relationship, and how it shapes not only how we view ourselves, but it also shapes how we interact with the world around us in our primary relationships, like our marriages, in our parent-child relationships, but also in our relationships with neighbors and coworkers and friends at church and on and on and on. And so looking at and understanding attachment is pivotal to our understanding of what it means to be human. You know, the truth is attachment, even though the theory of attachment and the ideas around it started in the 60s and 70s with Bowlby and Ainsworth and continued on, they really are just building on God's idea. Attachment is God's idea. It was his design. God says in his word that let us, God, the triune God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, let us make man in our own image. And because God is relational as the triune God, and he makes us in his image, then we are made to be relational. We were designed to be relational. We also see that even in the creation account when it says that after he created everything and he said it was good and said it was good and said it was good, he made man and he said, it's not good. First time God says something wasn't good that he created, he said, it's not good that man should be alone. And he made a helper suitable for him. He made Eve to pair up with Adam. And by the way, he's never changed that, right? There was no statute of limitations on that. There was no recall. God hasn't changed his mind. He still says it's not good for man to be alone. We were designed to be in relationship with others. So it's God's idea. From the beginning, God wanted us to be in relationship. God designed us to be in relationship, but things get broken. And, you know, we do at the marriage workshop, we talk about all the different ways that attachment kind of gets broken, gets wonky, and all the different ways that that plays out in our marriages and in our relationships. But today I really want to focus on the positive side, what God designed us to be and how he designed us to relate as secure connectors. So when we're talking about a secure connector, we're talking about lots of different components, but one of the main things that I want us to hold on to is that every single one of us looks for those relationships, looks for those connections. So Kurt Thompson, in his landmark book, The Soul of Shame, says, every one of us is born into a world, into the world, looking for someone looking for us. Every one of us is born into the world looking for someone looking for us. In other words, we're not just observing and finding it interesting what we're observing. We are intentionally looking for someone who wants to connect with us, who wants to know us, who wants to love us, because to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known. We can't separate those two. And so we come into the world looking for that. And the people who make the deepest connection with us, who have those secure connections with us, do a few things really, really well. One of the first things they do really well is that they're accessible, or they're attuned to us. In the attachment language, you would read about attunement. But are they accessible? In other words, can I reach you? Can I get a hold of you? Can I get your attention? Are you responsive to me? If you guys remember, for those of you who are my age or near my age, back in the day when you were in your car and you're listening to the radio and you had to tune in the radio station, and in between the different bands, there was static. And as you got closer and closer to the band you were trying to tune into, the signal got clearer and clearer. And so as you do that, as you're attuned to that other person, you're tuning into their frequency. You're getting closer and closer. You're accessible to them. You're not too busy. You're not distracted. You're not just watching TV, reading the paper, constantly going to the golf course or the gym or to work or whatever. You're accessible to me. I can reach you. Okay, so accessibility is one. Number two is responsiveness. Can I rely on you to respond to me emotionally? Do you pay attention to how I'm communicating? Not just the words that I'm saying, but also the emotion behind it. Are you responsive to me? Can I rely on you to pay attention and respond to the things that I'm sharing, the things that I'm going through? In other words, are you interacting with me? Or are you just a wall that my words, my emotions, my pain are just bouncing off of? And then finally, there's engagement. People who are secure connectors are able to engage or be emotionally present. This isn't just, I'm listening, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Okay, that's interesting. No, this is, I value you, and I value what you bring to the table, and I want to stay close to you. I'm not doing it just to appease you. I'm not just staying in the conversation, you know, kind of, yeah, okay, all right. Yes, I have to sit here. I can't look at my phone because you're making me. No, I want to know. I'm enthralled with what you have to say, what you have to offer. I'm paying attention. I want to know more. I want to know you so that I can love you even better than I do. Okay, so those who are secure connectors are accessible, they're responsive, and they're engaged. A-R-E. So, are you reachable? Are you responsive? Are you engaged or emotionally present with me? When you do those things, I know that you are establishing and maintaining a secure connection with me, and that helps me feel safe. That helps me feel secure. It teaches me that I have something valuable to offer, that I matter. And when that happens, that helps me to develop into the person that God designed me to be. It helps me to be all that God wants me to be. So what does this look like in our family of origin? Okay, now listen, it's really important that you understand nobody does this perfectly. No one does it perfectly. We all mess up. I always say to my kids, look, I have to give you something to talk to your therapist about when you grow up, right? So we're all going to mess up along the way. Some of us are going to mess up a lot. Some of us are going to mess up less than a lot, but we're all going to mess up. All have sinned and fall short of the glory, right? Okay, so your family of origin, what you grew up in, probably didn't look like this all of the time. But was it the majority of the time? Maybe just like 51% of the time. Could you see this happening on a regular basis with your family? So people who develop a secure connection had parents who were attuned to them, and not just them as an entity, but who they are. What did they like and not like? What were they about? What were your favorite things, your favorite hobbies, your favorite toys? What was your favorite color? Did they know that you preferred to eat your sandwiches without bread? did they know that you needed to make sure to lay out your clothes the night before in order to get a good night's sleep? Did they know you? Were they attuned to you? Were they trustworthy? Did they do what they say they were going to do? Did they show up when they say they were going to show up? Did they make sure that they signed up for the teams that you wanted to before the deadline? Were they trustworthy? People who are secure connectors had parents who also allowed their children to have feelings. They didn't say your feelings are too much. When you're done being upset, you can come back and join the family. But until then, you need to stay in your room. You're crying, I'll give you something to cry about, right? That's not allowing the child to have feelings. So people who are secure connectors grow up in a home where the parent allows the child to have feelings and teaches the child how to deal with their feelings in a healthy and respectful way. So it's not you go hide in your room until you calm down and then you can rejoin us. It's, hey, yes, I understand that you're upset. Let's talk about what we do when we're upset. Let's talk about what we do when we're angry. Let's talk about what we do when we're sad. Of course, it's okay to be sad. Of course, it's okay to be angry. Of course, it's okay to be happy or thrilled. Here's how we deal with those feelings, how we feel and deal with those feelings. And then finally, parents who allow their child to be a kid, to make mistakes, to mess up and then learn from it, rather than, how dare you? I can't believe it. It's got to be perfect. It's got to be right the first time. No. A child who learns to become a secure connector grows up in a home where it's okay to make mistakes and learn. Again, we're not talking about families who did this perfectly all the time. We're talking about families who did this regularly, that this was the norm. This is what I was used to experiencing. When you grow up in a home like this, you become a secure connector. Now, some of you may be sitting out there going, well, JJ, you described the opposite of what I grew up in. That family that you just described is nothing like what I grew up in. So does that mean I can never become a secure connector? No, it does not. It means that you have some work to do. It means that it's going to be more challenging for you than the person who did grow up in a family like this. But the reason we can all become secure connectors is because God parents us this way. God is attuned to who we are. He knows us fully. The scriptures tell us that he knows every hair on our head. He knows us intimately. And he's trustworthy. We can trust in God. He always does what he says he's going to do. All of his promises are yes and amen in Jesus, right? So there is nothing that God has ever said that he didn't follow through on. He's trustworthy. He allows us to have our feelings. He doesn't tell us, no. When you've calmed down, then you can come back to me. Read the Psalms, full of all kinds of emotions expressed to God freely. God allows us to have our feelings. He teaches us how to deal with our feelings. And throughout Scripture, he teaches us what to do when we are sad or afraid or we're angry. He teaches us how to deal with our feelings, but he doesn't tell us not to have feelings. And then finally, we certainly see God allowing us to make mistakes. He certainly understands that we're going to make mistakes. The word Israel, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Israel means one who wrestles with God. And he called the people of God, not the Mosesites, not the Abrahamites, not the Isaacites. He called them the Israelites, the ones who wrestle with God. And the church is the new Israel. Okay, so God understands. He sent Jesus to die on the cross because we were going to make mistakes, a lot of them, and they needed to be accounted for. And so he did that. But he allows us to make mistakes and then learn from them. He doesn't want us to continue in that way. He says to us, just like the woman caught in adultery, neither do I condemn you, but go and sin no more. So God parents us as a secure connector. He teaches us how to be secure connectors. And he does so by showing us how Jesus was a secure connector. Jesus, we see Jesus being available to people. We see Jesus being responsive to people. We see Jesus being engaged with people. We see Jesus connecting to his own heart. We see him connecting to the Father's heart, and we see him connecting to the hearts of those around him. In Mark 14, it says, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." And he says to his friends, "Stay here and keep watch." So on the night that he's about to be betrayed, on the night before he's going to go to the cross, and he's overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, so he's connected to his own heart, he also connects with his friends, and he says, "Come with me and keep watch." He doesn't do it by himself. He's inviting others to be with him. And then he goes to the Father, and he asks God to take the cup from him, but he's connected enough to the Father's heart to know that God says, "No, this is the path for you. Okay, not my will, but yours be done." Jesus regularly connected with the Father, regularly connected with his own heart, and regularly connected with his close friends, his allies, his disciples, the ones who were in it with him. Maybe the best example, not the best example, a good example, let me say it that way, a good example of the way that Jesus displayed accessibility, responsiveness, and engagement. Do you remember in Luke chapter 8? By this time, all of the crowds were just surrounding Jesus everywhere he went. And there's a moment where he goes across the sea to the man who had the legion of demons. On the way, the storm comes in, and Jesus tells the winds and waves to be still, and they do, and the disciples are amazed. And then he goes and casts the demons, the legion of demons, out of this man who's finally set free, and they go into the pig, and the pigs jump into the water, right? Now they come back, and there's another crowd just waiting for Jesus, and they're pressing in all around him. And Jairus comes to him and says, "My daughter is sick. Would you come and heal her?" Jesus goes with him. On the way, as the crowds are pressing in all around where he can barely move, the woman who had an issue of blood for 12 years, which is the same age of Jairus' daughter, this issue of blood for 12 years comes up behind him, touches his cloak, and is instantly healed. And in the midst of this chaos and in the middle of a mission, he's on a mission to go and heal Jairus' daughter. In that moment, Jesus pauses. He stops and he says, "Who touched me?" And no one answers. And she's afraid because she's really not supposed to even be in the crowd. She's supposed to be separated because she's unclean. She's supposed to be separated from people. She's supposed to be separated from the community. And can you imagine what it must have been like for her? To have been ostracized, marginalized, kept out of the community for 12 years. And she takes this risk. She's vulnerable. She takes this risk and she goes and she touches Jesus' cloak. because she believes that she can get healed just by touching his garment. And she is. And so Jesus stops everything. He's asking. No one answers. Finally, in terror, she comes up and says it was her. And Jesus talks to her. Okay, again, there's a ministry that has to happen, right? Jesus has been called to heal Jairus' daughter. And Jairus is a synagogue ruler. He's an important man. And the crowds are pressing in because they all want a piece of Jesus. But Jesus pauses and speaks to this woman. He was accessible to her. He was responsive. He could have just kept going. Like in the moment that he noticed that power went out from him, he could have just kept going and, oh, she's healed. And he could have kept going. But no, he knew that she needed more than just a physical healing. She needed to be restored. She needed to be restored to the community. And so he's not just accessible. He's responsive and he's engaged. He engages with her. And he says to her, your faith has made you well. He brings dignity to her, a woman who at least for 12 years was ostracized by the community. He restores her dignity. And this is what it means to be a secure connector. This is what it means to be accessible and responsive and engaged. I hope that we are challenged by this, not from the perspective of, oh, well, Jesus did it, but I'm not Jesus. I can't do this. I hope that we can see, no, Jesus told us that we would do even greater works than him if we would be filled with his Spirit. And so as we're filled with his Spirit and as God teaches us to be secure connectors, we can do even greater works. We can be Jesus' hands and feet. We can be the ones who are accessible and responsive and engaged with a hurting world around us. And that starts in our families. That starts in the ways that we interact with our spouses. That starts in the way that we interact with our children, our parents, our siblings, our neighbors, our friends in our small group and in the larger church and then in the greater church and in the world around us. We want to be secure connectors. We want to be accessible and responsive and engaged just the way Jesus was and is in our lives today.
I'm sure you like JJ's teaching and you'll want to join us for the next Club New Life Zoom gathering August 6th at 7 p.m. Central Time, where we'll hear from Stacy Smith, who is our speaker from Restore, and she'll be speaking on Beauty from Brokenness, How God Redeems Pain into Purpose. Living with another person can sometimes be like two trains colliding, each steamrolling through life like we do, and then we collide. That collision has the potential for different results. We got another Rebecca call. Rebecca's a good name. Dr. Alice Benton and Dr. Jackie Mack Harris addressed Rebecca's concern when her husband accused her of having a callous heart. Next, we'll hear from J.J. West and Mark Cameron, who come alongside of Alaya, who struggled to surrender to God's request. Next, Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer shares how boundaries are like a bar of soap. Sound interesting? Let's listen in.
Let's go to Vero Beach. Here is Rebecca listening on Sirius XM channel 131. Welcome, Rebecca, to New Life Life.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Yeah, how can we help you today?
I'm really struggling with something I need help with. I've been blessed to have a wonderful husband. We have a Christian marriage. We are on our 20th year of marriage. And unfortunately, there's still an issue, and it seems to lie with me. And I need help learning how to get rid of it. My husband has lovingly brought to my attention that I seem to have a calloused heart towards, I guess, really being able to help him feel loved, cherished, and appreciated and respected. And I don't realize that I have this callous per se. He believes it's from past hurts.
So give us
in childhood and growing up.
So you have this calloused heart. How are you wondering how to fix it?
Yes, ma'am. I guess because I don't even realize that it's there.
Because it might not be.
But obviously so, it's apparent.
Hold on for a second. So it might not be a calloused heart. That might be limiting you a bit. So when you say the phrase a calloused heart is trying to describe some action and behavior, what is the action and behavior that he is labeling a calloused heart? What is it that you do?
I guess occasionally comes out maybe a disrespectful action of some sort that I don't intend to be disrespectful, mm-hmm. but it comes out that way.
What would the action be?
It could be, I guess what he tells me is that I haven't considered his heart in the like what I'm saying, so it comes off very callous.
Okay, so let me give you an example. So it sounds like you and your husband could be having a conversation and you tell him some things that are your ideas, but you haven't factored him in, but this is what you're thinking. And so it maybe just comes out as law. This is what it is. And he doesn't feel considered. Or he shares something and you say, no, it's not like that. And then you share your perspective. Does that resonate at all?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So it may feel to him like you're not valuing his thoughts because your perspective is different than his. And one of the things in couples therapy that we work with people to realize is that perspective taking is necessary for healthy communication. And it doesn't mean that we're wrong. And so if the two of you are standing in a room facing each other and I ask you to describe that room, you would describe it differently because you're looking in different directions. You're in the same space, but you're looking in different directions. You have different vantage points. And so when he shares his perspective, his vantage point, rather than deny it because it's different than yours, and you may not even be denying it. It may just be your word choice. Because a lot of times my husband will say, oh, no. And then he tells me his thing. He's not saying I'm wrong. But no is just the instinct to say, because that's how we're socialized. So rather than do that, just mirror back what he says. He says, hey, you know, I don't like it when the kitchen floor is gritty. We've got to stop letting them track sand to the house. And rather than say, oh, no, that was because, you know, we had gone to the beach and I was just trying to clean everything. Rather than do that, just say, okay, I hear what you're saying. You don't want sand tracked through the kitchen. Okay. Thanks for letting me know, right? Rather than challenge it and try to defend yourself, because that's probably what's happening. You're explaining. We want to give an account for why we did or said what we did or said and explain things away. And so I think the book How We Love could be really helpful for teaching the two of you the comfort circle, which is an excellent way of communicating in which both parties get heard and we can get deeper as to what's underneath those emotions. And sometimes we are feeling things like I believe he may be feeling some things that's triggered him to some other times where he's felt disrespected and not listened to and like what he had to say wasn't valued. And that's coming up when you're in these conversations with him.
Alice. Rebecca, my husband told me not too long ago, he said, you're not listening to me very well lately. And I thought, baloney, I'm a professional listener. I listen well all the time. But I know better than to say that. So I did what Jackie is teaching you to do. I said, oh, huh, would you tell me more about that? You feel like I don't listen to you well. And he had some instances where, in fact, he was right and I was wrong. I had been distracted. So there was truth to it that I wasn't aware of. I had a blind spot. But there was also historical pain for him of having other people in his life drastically not listen well to him. That doesn't hold true for me. But sometimes I don't listen very well to him. And so by allowing that your husband's history could be exacerbating the feeling he has with you, and yours could too. But the point is to not be defensive. And to listen in order to understand or to have the priority of connecting versus correcting. And that makes all the difference. And the comfort circle that Jackie's talking about is pretty miraculous. It gets you there real quick.
It is miraculous. And I've watched things be connected that none of us would have ever expected to have connected. And the change and the breakthrough is amazing. And then also intimacy in marriage is coming up. Mm-hmm. I really encourage you to encourage your husband to be at the next intimacy in marriage. Do whatever you can do to be there.
And Rebecca, your humility is going to make all the difference. Mm-hmm. We usually have callers call in and say, this person is doing this and that. How can I change them? Rarely do we have people say, I guess I have a problem I didn't know of. How can I change that? Humility changes so much because it floods in grace into the home. Well done.
Yes.
Aaliyah, welcome to New Life Live, and thanks for listening to us on the New Life app.
Hi, yeah. My question is, how can I cope with surrendering to God when he asked me to do crazy stuff? And the crazy stuff is because yesterday I was at church and I just had this random thought like, hey, and I was talking to the ladies in the church and I was like, I need to get rid of my books because there's a lot of them that have like cussing in it and like very dirty scenes in it. And I'm like, can you guys offer me a like good like Christian recommendation? And last night, I got in my bed about 11 o'clock midnight, and God told me, he was like, get those books and, you know, put them in a tote. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Eventually, yeah, I got up, put the books in the tote, and then there was this one book that, like, broke my heart. And I'm like, God, please let me finish reading this book. God, I just started it. And I eventually put it in the tote, but it was very hard for me.
Mm-hmm. Was it one of these books that has explicit scenes and language in it too?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. But you wanted to finish this book in particular. Why is that?
It was the third book in a series.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you just wanted to finish the series. JJ, what do you think?
And what's your question, Aaliyah? Could you restate it again?
So, like, how can I cope with surrendering to God when he asks me to do crazy stuff?
Like getting rid of all your books.
Yeah, like getting rid of all your books.
And when you say when you say like, cope, what do you mean by that, cope? Did you do it?
Like,
are you struggling to do it?
I did it. Like all the books that was in my room, I still have to go through my storage unit. But it's just like very heartbreaking because I don't know how much money I spent on all my books, but I do have like a mini library. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I don't know what to do on my books.
So God just told you to put them in a tote bag or something. Did he say throw them away or burn them or give them away or anything like that?
Not yet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. JJ, what do you think?
Aaliyah, you're in good company because the scripture is filled with people who God said to do some kind of crazy things. And many of them struggled with those instructions. Many of them delayed following through on those instructions. Many of them came up with their own plan, nuanced what God suggested or what God commanded. Some of them did the exact opposite of what God told them to do. So you're in good company. And by the way, all of us, right? Myself included, it is sometimes really hard to surrender to God's will because we are short-sighted. We only see the immediate, what's in front of us. And God sees it all. He has the whole of history, the whole timeline of history before him because he's outside of time. And trusting in him is good for us, but it can be really, really difficult. So there's a couple of things I think that can be helpful in this regard. Whenever we're trying to understand and then follow through on God's will, God's direction, we want to look at four streams or four ways that God communicates with us. Certainly he communicates through his word, right? The Holy Bible, and that's unerring, infallible. And so anytime we get something in scripture, thou shalt not kill. Okay. It's pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of nuance there. Nothing hard to figure out there. Correct. But then he also communicates with us through prayer, through things that we sense, like what happened with you is you're sitting in your room or on your bed or whatever, and you just sense God say, go and get those books, put them in a tote right now. Okay, so that's a different way, but it's more subjective. How do I know that this was God and not just me and my thoughts? And that's where we want to run it through the first one, which is God's word, but we also want to run it through the third one, which is that scripture tells us that there's great wisdom in the counsel of many. Mm. In other words, God speaks to us through other wise people. People who walk with the Lord. And so it's always good. Anytime I get a sense that God is leading me to do a thing or not do a thing is to talk with my fellow believers who I know walk with the Lord, who have wisdom to say, hey, here's what I'm sensing. What do you get? What do you think? What do you think about this? How should I do this? And then finally, circumstances, and we can get into that later. But certainly walking through those four streams, whenever all four line up, that gives us a pretty clear indication this is where God's leading us. But we also recognize sometimes he asks us to surrender things that are hard to let go of because we're trusting in something that he wants us to let go of so we can more accurately trust in him.
Mark?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't have tons to say. I think JJ really covered it well. I mean, here's what I would say to you, Ilya, because I think we all struggle with this. And as JJ said, you know, the sermon yesterday actually was on Abraham and having to sacrifice Isaac. So obviously not quite the same thing, but metaphorically, it is the same thing here. And sometimes we don't understand why God wants us to do something, but it sounds like in this situation, you clearly do understand why God wants you to do it. And I'm sure other people can probably correlate with this. I mean, I've struggled with this too, where I'm in the middle of watching a show or a series, and then stuff happens in there, and you're like, I don't know if I want to continue watching this. And that happened to me recently, and I'd watched the whole season of this one show, and then I'm like halfway through the second, and I'm like, I'm not going to watch the rest of it. It just doesn't really resonate with my values. Yeah. And so I just stopped doing it. And, you know, it's hard at first to do that, especially when you're really into something. But here's what I would challenge you. If you really spent a lot of money on something and you purchased something and then you realized that that thing was actually causing you cancer, would you continue using it if you knew it was slowly killing you? I don't know if you would. What do you think about that thought?
No, I wouldn't. That's why it was like pretty easy to get rid of every other book except for that one. But my also hang up is God hasn't told me, you know, where to take these books. So I'm thinking, let me, you know, donate it to the library. But also my other thought is, am I enabling other people to pick up these books if I put them, you know, take them to the library?
Well, that's a really good thought, because if it's not good for you, should it be good for other people? So I encourage you to ponder on that. I think you just take it step by step right now. I mean, that's what Abraham did in the story with Isaac. He just took it step by step and God told him what to do in the end. So I think you really know what to do. It's just hard. But, you know, Jesus once said, wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart is.
We need boundaries. Boundaries. And you know what? Boundaries, I think, at times are like a bar of soap. Like when something happens and you're hurt, you reach for that boundary and somehow it just keeps slipping out of your hand and falling on the floor. But there's three basic principles when you're thinking about boundaries to figure out what you're supposed to do, if anything. So last night I got home and I just moved into a new place and I got home at 10:45. Yesterday was trash day, right? So you take your trash cans out. I've only been there 2 weeks and I stuck them out there. I got home last night and my trash cans were gone.
Like gone, gone.
Gone, gone, disappeared.
Not just the trash in them.
No, that would have been nice and they would have left the trash can. But if you can imagine, I'm coming home. I haven't been there that long. Now, you all have heard me say that shame is the culprit of chaos. Shame. And those trauma-induced shame beliefs that we have in our lives because of other situations that happened, they just pop up. Like, you know, they're in your mind before you even know they're in your mind. So I bounced all over the place from feeling powerless, helpless, from the thought that went through my head. I looked around and I thought, okay, well, if somebody took my trash cans, I'm going to take somebody else's trash cans. Now, can you believe that's an offending behavior? That comes from shame because somebody, trauma-induced shame belief, somebody hurt me. And so I want to take back what's rightfully mine. But that means I have to go into offending, stealing behavior. I was like, no, that's not the right. Don't go there. But it came into my mind. So powerless, helpless, I'll take something back. So then I got on the phone this morning with our trash company. And I thought about my chapter in my book, which is called No is a Complete Sentence. And in that chapter, it's all about boundaries. And the three steps are when you've been impacted by somebody or something, it's do you want to ask these questions? Who is the owner of the problem? Who is in control?
of the problem and who's responsible to fix it. Right? Now, if I wasn't thinking clearly and I didn't go through these three steps, I'm like, somebody has a problem with stealing. Mm-hmm. And I could have sat there in the victim seat.
Yeah.
And done nothing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got on the phone, I called the trash company, I reached out to the HOA, I had to read this whole manual to find out what to do, you know, with trash cans. But I decided to do the right thing. That was, I'm taking responsibility for my life.
Yeah.
I'm in control of what I can do to fix this problem. And that's what I did. I got two trash cans coming. From Yay. The trash company at no charge.
Brand new ones, and they don't stink or anything.
Have you ever thought one thing and found out that you might not have been right? Or thought things were going to go one way and they didn't? Sometimes when you look back, it might have been wise to analyze why you might be thinking a certain way or having certain expectations and ask, is this correct? Am I thinking straight? Our emotions often lead us into the most bizarre directions, and relationships need to have a foundation of truthfulness and trust. Dr. Alice Benton and Dr. Jackie McHarris address Michael regarding his girlfriend that he hopes to become his wife. Our final call features Chris Williams and Jim Burns as they help Jenny with her concerns for her granddaughter's choice in dating. Dr. Sherry closes things out with a short teaching on anxiety has fallen upon you.
Here's Michael in Toronto, Canada. He is listening on newlife.com. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling in today.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How can we help you?
This is something that's been on my mind for quite some time now. I'm tortured by my own imagination, so to say. So here goes. I feel awful that my girlfriend already had sexual experiences with other guys in her past. And it poisons me to know that I'll never be her first. And that even though I've more or less saved myself for marriage and, you know, I still have that first experience. But I don't know. It's not something that changes anything with, well, at least me. We've been dating for almost a year now, but for quite some time now, I've known that she's the one. And I plan to propose sometime this September. But I don't feel like this is something I can talk to her about, and I don't feel there's any use in it because she's never, like, talked about this herself, and she seems to be well over her past. But these past months, I seem to be, like, obsessed with it in thought, and I don't know what to do with myself.
How old are you, Michael?
I'm 24.
And is she about the same age?
She turned 26 this March.
Okay.
So,
Michael, are you hard on yourself when you make mistakes?
Yes.
And were your parents the kind that really called you up to live well and do right?
Yeah, you could say that.
Mm-hmm. And how did they discipline you and talk to you when you didn't do well?
I was, well, I guess still am the kind of person who doesn't really, like, I've never really needed to be disciplined. Like, I would be, well, my parents were out at work or studying in university, I would, like, they could comfortably leave me at home and I wouldn't cause any trouble.
You're a trustworthy guy, so you have not had to face that.
I guess not. I was always the quiet kind.
Okay.
So,
did you see a sibling or anybody else that was close to you make a big mistake and it really impacted you?
It impacted me in what sort of way?
Oh, scared you, worried you. Made it hard to be in relationship with that person, pre-girlfriend that you're talking to about now. Yeah? What comes to mind?
My little sister is, she is going to be turning 11, and she is not as, I guess, naturally well-behaved as I am, and she gets caught lying about stuff pretty frequently, and, well, there's been a couple times that she has done this to me, and I can't help but distrust her to an extent now. Every time she says something like, oh, that's the truth, but what about those other times?
Do you also fear that your future wife won't be faithful to you because she has been sexually active in the past?
No.
You mentioned that your imagination kind of runs wild with you. I'm not sure if that's the phrase you'd use, but that you're struggling with, you just can't stop thinking about it. Are you having trouble with what she has done, imagining what she's done? Are you maybe fearful of comparison?
No, I'm actually not concerned with that at all. Use that phrase very specifically because the other thing is that since I was in my early teens, I've been watching pornography. So I know what it looks like, even though I've never done it myself. And it kind of crushes me. And I don't know why. We've been dating for almost a year now. First 6 months, this has never entered my mind. These past few months, I literally can imagine standing here. I don't know if she's maybe dated two or three guys in the past. I forget. I can imagine two or three people standing there who, made her feel things I wish only I ever did. Mm. And again, even though I've, so to say, saved myself for marriage, I'm far from pure in this regard. Mm-hmm.
It is so brave and humble of you that you acknowledge that to us. Because when you feel as strongly as tortured by your imagination, as you said, there's meaning behind it. There are deeper roots to that that, of course, have to do with your girlfriend. And this is sad that you don't get to be the first one to have this experience with her. But it's bigger than a normal sadness. And so it means there's history to it. We use this phrase that if we have an emotion that seems hysterical, it's just so big, then it's probably because it's historical. And so the path out of this, Michael, is to start to talk more with your girlfriend about your own humble admission of pornography use and about how you feel about her history, not to do it at all in an accusatory way, but rather in a confession mode. This is what I'm carrying, and I don't want to feel like this towards you. I don't want to bring this into our marriage. So let's help each other to work through this. And probably having a counselor and doing it as premarital counseling, because this is heavy for both of you. It might be too big for a conversation just between the two of you. Would you consider taking that path?
Perhaps, but... Well, I have no idea how to take on that kind of conversation with her. I know there will never be a good time to do it, but I mean, I don't even know where to start. And quite frankly, I'm a little scared of what the consequences of that might be. And furthermore, the last thing I'd say is, again, she never talks about past relationships. I've never even gotten the hint that she is comparing me in any sort of way. So I'm afraid that if I bring this up, she will, after that, start being self-conscious about her past. And,
so how do you know that she's been sexually involved? You're sure about that, though? I mean, just because she's gone out with a few guys before, I mean, she has mentioned this to you at some point?
I guess I never asked directly, but I'm quite sure of it. I haven't asked because... I really don't want to know the details because it will hurt even more to know. But I'm sorry, to answer your question, again, it's been almost a year now. I vaguely remember making some joke that suggested about something to do with sex. I know this sounds vulgar, I promise you it wasn't, but... And she sort of froze up for just half a second.
And so you read that you read that as confirmation. Michael, you keep a lot of thoughts and emotions in your head. You're not with us right now, but I think your tendency is to think things through a lot. But because you don't know how to bring it up, you don't say it. And she's also quiet. And so these, of course, most difficult topics to address, you two struggle with that. And I hear your fear. Michael, the good news is that that's what counselors are here for, because we have conversations like this every day with people in our offices. So we know how to get through the awkwardness. We know how to do it diplomatically so that it's healing rather than destructive. But you're right. It is a risk to address with her, because if she doesn't know about your pornography use, you don't know what her reaction will be. She might be scared and she might back off. So a recommendation we make, if she doesn't know about it yet, is that you get help for that part of your life first before revealing it to her, so that when you reveal it soon, you can say, I've got this many weeks, months of sobriety. This is what I'm doing about it, but it is a part of my past that you have a right to know.
And you do want to have these conversations. It can only make things better. You want to have them. You said there's no good time. The good time is before you say I do.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said that he might propose to her in September. So
make it before September.
Make it before September, yes. For sure. Here is Jenny from Philadelphia listening on WBYN. Welcome, Jenny, to New Life Live.
Why, thank you. I'm calling because I'm really concerned. Our 25-year-old granddaughter has been dating a Muslim. I've had them over for dinner. She lives with her dad, and she had accepted Jesus when she was a little girl, but she hasn't been raised in the church, only when she's with us, because she lives in a different state. So she's coming over tomorrow, and we're having a daytime together. And I just need to really talk about this, because they're wanting her to convert. They're teaching her Arabic, and they've taken her to different functions. She's just being inundated with attention from when she wakes up in the morning until she goes to bed at night. This man is always calling her and seeing how she is and just giving her all kinds of loving attention. Really scary to me.
Now, are they engaged or just dating right now?
No. Dating. Yeah.
Wow. What do you guys say?
Yeah.
Well, I think you do want to give her some advice, your grandma, and that's great. But I think you want to ask a lot of questions. Sometimes I think you can get more input to and from your granddaughter by, not making it too dramatic, but just simply saying, honey, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and I wonder, and I know this man has given you a lot of attention, and I know that you really, really like him. Have you thought about, and then fill in the blank? And
okay.
And I would ask her those kind of questions. See if she's thought through some of this process, because maybe she has, maybe she hasn't. And in some ways, your questions may put her into disequilibrium, if you would. And what I mean by that is it may cause her to go, wow, I've not really thought much about that. It is true that when you look at in premarital counseling, one of the things we look at is do they have a compatibility with faith, and do they have a compatibility with other, parts of life? And I'll be honest with you, a lot of times, again, you said she made a commitment to Jesus, but she hasn't been really living it out. But, when a Christian is involved with a Muslim, there are not just compatibility issues. There's huge ones, of course, with the religion. But there's also ones in terms of just the way they live. Arabic. She's learning Arabic or whatever. So I would ask some of those kinds of questions and let her know, put her on notice that if she ever wants to talk to you, stay safe with her. So I wouldn't get too preachy or lectury, which you don't seem like that kind of person anyway, but I wouldn't get too preachy or lectury, because I think you might then lose the safety that you can have from her if something does come up. Now, there are, deep concerns, and I understand those deep concerns. I would ask a lot more questions than give advice, although if she asks you for advice, I would give her your advice. I always say, do they know what you believe? Do they know how you feel? Sure. You want to give that to them, and especially if they're going to ask you. So it's a dialogue. Create a dialogue as opposed to just grandma saying, here's what my concerns are. That's what I do.
Yeah. I've had them over for dinner, and I've observed his behavior, and he's very sweetly controlling.
Yeah.
And he even showers me with attention, and I'm very uncomfortable with it. I don't like gifts, and I don't like the familiarity that he assumes with me.
Yeah, he hasn't earned it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not his grandma.
I think that to just piggyback on what Jim was saying is asking questions about what I call reality questions, mm-hmm. reality yeah. checks, right? What is a life of a woman like in this religious environment?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would your days look like? Mm-hmm. What would your decision making be like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also more positive questions like this. What do you find compelling, or what do you find interesting, or is there something attractive about this? Because a lot of times, Jenny, what we find in these high controlling environments is that's what people are attracted to. The certainty of the control.
Right.
It eliminates ambiguity. People are compelled by that type of clarity. And so, especially if they're, you know, early 20s is a, or mid 20s, you know, 20s is a very vulnerable time where we're trying to find our place in the world and the place in which we belong. And if someone offers that on a silver platter and we just have to give up control to get it, oftentimes that's an exchange rate people will give. However, by asking reality-based questions, it can help snap them out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we just even put religion aside. There's an ethnic issue where is she comfortable being dominated in a relationship? Because if you look at the Middle East, that's how they do marriage and that's how they do relationships.
Well, we know that, but he says, well, they are not like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I find from him, I'm never getting clear answers. Mm-hmm. Everything is fuzzy.
Right.
So I've done research on my own, and I know part of their new culture is that they can do that, and they can be deceitful, basically, and that is what I know he's doing. So that's why I'm really. Sure. Upset. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's why you're going to ask good questions. I think you'll be wonderful. And playing it down the road, let's pretend that they go farther. You don't want that. You're hoping that that doesn't happen.
But if you
say to her, you know, and I'm using the word safe again, saying, you know what, if there ever is something that makes you feel uncomfortable in this, or all of a sudden it doesn't look right, because I've heard that happen sometimes, you know, I want you to call me. And so you're also saying, I'm in this with you for the long haul. Mm-hmm. And I frankly, by your questions, she'll understand that you don't love this and you're not accepting it. But you also can say, if you want to talk, because she may not be getting that from somebody else. And so she may, you know, in a moment of, you know, as this thing gets farther down the road, you may truly be that one safe person for her that she knows has her best interest in mind.
I wanted to touch on anxiety. There's a premise in Ireland when it comes to emotions that they say anxiety has fallen upon you. So instead of saying, I am anxious, when we say I am anxious, it's possible that we might actually be making anxiety our identity. I am anxious. Just saying I am anxious. It becomes our identity instead of the idea that anxiety has fallen upon you. I want to explain why worship music is actually a powerful intervention for anxiety, when anxiety has fallen upon you. Do you know that all anxiety, and this is according to Dr. Russell Kennedy, who is an MD and somebody who specializes in anxiety, believes that all anxiety is separation anxiety. All anxiety has to do with separation. So if you are anxious and you're feeling separated, what we often do is we start thinking about why I am anxious. And we go up into our thoughtful brain instead of our emotional brain. We go up into the thoughtful brain. We start thinking about all the reasons that we're anxious about a situation that we're in. Now, the situation that we're in, it could be with somebody you know, somebody you love at work, and they're challenging. But when we lose touch with who we are, and our capacity to make choices and decisions, and we lose touch with whose we are, as far as being attached and not separated from God, we fall further into feelings of anxiety. Now, we have this strange thing. It's called the vagus nerve. It actually starts from the lower part of our brain all the way through our spinal cord, all the way down to our tailbone. We sit on, you know, we sit down and our vagus nerve travels like a superhighway. Well, this vagus nerve actually goes through our vocal cords. I was just listening to somebody speak recently and was hearing that she said that because that vagus nerve goes through our vocal cords, whatever we say, or when we worship, or when we draw on scripture that grounds us into truths of who God is, we quiet down. We can actually slow down and quiet that vagus nerve by worshiping.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? So we have a switch inside that we can turn off by attaching to our heart, attaching to who we are and whose we are. And so if anxiety has fallen upon you, mm-hmm. I want to just have you do a scientific experiment. Put on some worship.
Yeah.
Begin to sing a worship song that you love. And I would imagine that your vagus nerve will begin to quiet down. And you did that. You have the ability to take charge.
We have a saying here at New Life. It's never just another day at New Life. And this is true. This year, we have been going through a lot of changes to continue to offer help and hope to so many people. One of those changes is we have rebuilt our website at newlife.com. Along with that, we have new branding. You'll see it in everything that we send to you. But we're very excited about the messaging getting out to so many people. Whether you realize it or not, there are a lot of robots in our lives now. What we look at online, how we search for things, it is very technical and it makes a big difference in how we're able to reach out to so many people. And so in rebuilding the website, we are able to reach more and more people. And we're really excited about that opportunity. Here's some new things that are coming up that you can put on your calendar. We're going to have our next Club New Life Zoom August 6th, and we're going to have Everyman's Battle August 22nd through 24 in Cincinnati and September 26th through 28th in Orange County, California. On October 4th, we're going to have our online life recovery conference called Choosing Wisdom. Whether you're part of the recovery movement or just are curious, it's a great way to spend your day. You're going to learn so many things from so many different presenters. We've got our New Life courses that we continue to add, and you can find all of that at newlife.com. And if you really want to plan far ahead, you can mark your calendar for June of 2026, as we will be taking a river cruise to Paris, France. You can find out all of the information at newlife.com/river-cruise, or you can always call us 1-800-NEW-LIFE and we'll give you the information there. We don't use donations for our trips, but it's a great way for you to see the world and travel with your New Life family. We hope that you'll set sail with us next June. So as you plan your picnic and you spread out your blanket, know that New Life appreciates you all year long, and we pray for you. We call you from time to time to say thank you, and we also want to know if there's something that we can be praying about for you. We are one big family, and that's what family does. Well, sometimes family does that, but this family does. We're grateful for your faithful support, and if you need anything, please reach out to us. We are so grateful for you, and we look forward to the next time that we can connect with you. God bless.